Welcome to Rebuilding the Beast. My name is Festus Ezeli, NBA player turned podcast host. And on this show, I'm going to have my inspiring friends come on to take you through their rebuilding journeys. I hope you can take the tips from their stories and apply it to your life as well. Hey guys, today we have Bridget. Her story is fascinating. You know, she goes from dealing with alcohol issues at a very young age, you know, to now being sober for 7 years. The most impressive part of the story is the fact that she's now a therapist and she's using her story to help other people. You guys really, really will enjoy this episode because she goes into detail and tells you the story. It's like a roller coaster, you know, and I think it's important for people to hear this, whoever is struggling with trying to get their lives together, whoever is struggling with the process of the struggle of rebuilding themselves. I think that this is a story not just for people dealing with alcoholism. So I hope you enjoy this show, this story, this episode. It's going to be fun. Welcome to Rebuilding the Beast. I from the beginning, I just was attracted to your account on social media. Because the first thing I see on your account is your username, that.sober.mom. And it was like that sober mom, you're already telling your story from the beginning, a little bit of your story. Now I'm excited to hear your real story. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I was so excited to connect with you on there. And I'm sure you noticed like my account is very new on that platform. I just started it a couple weeks ago. I'm like already so blown away with how many amazing relationships I've built in such a short amount of time. So I'm really excited.
It's amazing how much impact you can make when you are vulnerable with your own story, because then you can connect with other people who are, you'd be surprised. We're all struggling with something. That's what Rebuilding the Beast is about, is we all have something that we're struggling with, and you can use your story to heal somebody else as well as yourself. You know, you can reflect on your story and heal somebody else. So I'm excited to dive into your story, and I want to hear it. And I will be honest from the beginning, I don't know much about alcohol and sobriety, and I'm really excited to learn about this process. Can you tell me a little bit of your story and your journey with sobriety and alcohol?
Looking back on my upbringing, you know, I had these alcoholic parents who really got out of control, like as I was getting older, you know, like older into high school and into like the early parts of my college, things were getting worse and worse in my house. And I had these two younger siblings and I felt responsible for them. I felt responsible for everybody in my house, my parents too. I was like the adult of the house. Mm. And I remember when it was time to apply to go to school. I applied to like several schools in the state of Florida. I knew I wanted to stay in state, but I ended up, you know, visiting a bunch and applying to like three or four different schools. And I picked the only one I hadn't visited that was the furthest away. So I went to Florida State. It was 6 hours from home. I wanted to stay in Florida, man, but be as far away from these people as I possibly
could. We hear stories. We were at Vanderbilt
and
we heard stories about Florida State.
wild yeah. times in Tallahassee. So I got there and I was like, yes, that was like an alcoholics playground. And I, you know, at that time I wasn't like questioning my relationship with alcohol at all at that point. You know, my drunks were very intermittent in high school because it was just like, you know, when my family had parties or when we did something. But I mean, I was always drinking at home when there was anything going on. We went on family vacations. I could drink on family vacations. They never cared. And I don't really think they were paying attention. you know, they had their own alcoholism to deal with. But I do remember thinking that, you know, finally getting that far away from home, I was like, I don't have to care anymore. Like, I don't have to care about them, what they're doing, how much they're fighting, if my brother and sister are okay. Like, I felt like I was off the hook, if that makes sense. So the effect kind of went from being like this fun social, like lubricant, you know, to being like a mechanism to just shut off. And I was a blackout party drinker. I was like I was the life of the party. I was like the best time. I was so much fun. I was always the most outgoing. I would be, you know, tearing up the dance floor. I was loud. I wanted to be friends with everybody. I was talkative. And I felt like alcohol enabled that side of me to come out. So that really doesn't sound so bad, right? But every time I drank, I blacked out. I didn't know how to stop. There was never an off switch. So I couldn't just like have two glasses of wine at dinner and call it a night. It was like, where are we going next? What are we doing next? That wasn't enough for me. So I wouldn't stop until I could forget.
So it's kind of interesting because now we're talking to Bridget, who has lived through this, and also Bridget, the therapist, who has analyzed this and who has healed herself, who is healing herself. Because that's what we talk about. We're building. It never stops. It's not like you get to a point and it's like, okay, I'm done now.
I'm cured. So, yeah.
Yeah. You're never really fully cured. You're always working on yourself. And that's what life is about. So at what point, though, because there's a lot of kids out there who will probably hear this and say, oh, well, this is just a college student. At what point, right. What is the difference between this? And when did you realize that it was a problem? Well, it's like, wow, I'm actually, this is not good for me.
Well, that's interesting because yeah, it's normalized behavior. Like you went to college, you know what it's like there. You could find anybody on any given Friday who does exactly what I just described.
Yeah, I know a lot of people.
And I mean,
I was that person a couple times too, because there's a couple of times where I got drunk and I thought, wow, I was having so much fun. Mm-hmm. And then I looked the next day, I saw videotapes. I'm like, yo,
I'm a mess.
It's not good. So for you, how did you get to that point when you realized it?
It was like, I never graduated is the best way to describe it. So I stayed at Florida State 5 years. And meanwhile, while all of this is going on, I'm party city. I'm going out 7 nights a week and somehow managing to still go to class. I've always been like a good student and school didn't feel that important to me at that time. I was more focused on like my freedom and my social life, but I like learning. I like school. I always have. And so I graduate on the president's list with like a 4.0, and I'm the president of the pre-law society. I'm in 2 other psychology honor societies. I'm double majored and I'm a full-blown alcoholic.
They call it functioning alcoholic?
Very high functioning.
High functioning, yes. Wow.
Incredibly, which is like how my dad was. So it's not surprising. Like anybody who saw me out at night would have been like, oh, that poor girl. Like she got some issues coming. But anybody who saw me in class, I'm sure I pissed people off too, because they knew what a lunatic I was. And then I could just show up, take a test, have barely studied, get an A. Like I just could pull it off. And I'm not trying to say like, oh, I'm so smart, but I've just always been a good student. I knew how to do just enough to get by. I was kind of always like that in my life where I would do just enough to be able to pull something off. But I didn't have the energy to fully give to anything. I was like barely hanging on by a thread at that point in my own life. But
that's crazy. Because if you're doing so well, it's so easy for you to mask it and be like, well, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. So,
right. Nobody could say anything to me. Yeah, I had amazing grades. I had 2 majors. I was in all these extracurricular clubs. I had a job. I had a boyfriend. I lived with my boyfriend in college. We were together for 5 years. Like we were together the whole time. So, you know, it wasn't like I was out making bad choices and like, you know, hooking up with guys and stuff like that. I had like what appeared to be a stable life, but I was nuts. The first time someone told me I was an alcoholic, I was 19. And I was like, you don't know what you're talking about. Like, if you want to see an alcoholic, go to my house right now and spend a few hours with my parents. That's alcoholism.
That's different. So you're saying like, you watch your parents say, I'm not going to be like them. I'm going to be,
exactly.
I'm going to take care of all my business, but this is just me being a college student.
Right. Everyone else is doing it. And that was my defense. I was in a sorority, actually, and I got called into, they call it standards. It's like the disciplinary board when you do something wrong. Mm. And I got called into standards and I was like, I didn't even do anything. Why do these people want to talk to me? So I went in there and they said, we got an anonymous letter from one of your sorority sisters that said that they're worried about your drinking and that you might be an alcoholic. Like, what do you think about that? And I laughed and told them, you know, go talk to my parents for a few hours. That's alcoholism. This is college. Anytime I'm out, there are five other sisters with me. It's not like I'm out here doing this by myself. Everyone's just as bad off as I am. Welcome to FSU. This is a college town. It's the number six party school in the country. Get over it. And I walked out of the room and slammed the door. I got kicked out the following year. I got kicked out. Me and a few other girls who definitely were partying too hard and broke a few rules and got kicked out. And at the time I was like, can you believe they did this to us? And now looking back, I'm like, that was a long time coming. It was
this
justified.
This is actually the point I want to emphasize. So, because when it's brought up to you, you're defensive. You're like, no, I'm good. This is what and then I want to go to the point where it's like, oh, I'm not good.
So I left school, I moved home, I got a job. And obviously like that kind of responsibility changes things a little bit. You're not in a college town anymore. You can't party like you used to, but I would find any reason to be out drinking, you know, on a Tuesday night after work. And I had some, you know, friends who were right there alongside me, but they were younger than me. So I realized eventually that like the crowd I was hanging out with, it could still afford to be out doing stuff like that. But I had like a full-time job and a little bit more responsibility. You know, I had like bills to pay and, you know, like a house to take care of and dogs to take care of. And I had this boyfriend and like, you know, it just, my life felt a little more adult. And I was still drinking like a 19-year-old. And instead of making any accommodations on the alcohol side of things, I decided to make accommodations to my lifestyle. So I left my full-time job.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I started my own business. So I did it with great motives. Like I'm going to better myself. I'm going to work for myself. You know, my parents always had like unconventional jobs and always were self-employed and had successful businesses. So I was like, you know, I got that spirit from my parents. I'm going to start my own business. So I did that, but I was, you know, not obviously making any money in the interim. So I started bartending. And what a great job for an alcoholic.
Easy access.
Very. It's, you know, you're not going to get in trouble for drinking on the job. It's endorsed. It's supported, you know, like have a drink when your customer buys you a drink. Take shots with people. Let them have a good time. You have a good time with them.
I've ran into bartenders that say they don't drink on the job.
I mean, it makes working a lot more difficult when you're intoxicated, but I worked in a fun party spot and it was, you know, have a good time. Make the other people have a good time. Tell them to spend money. You know, they're going to spend more money if they're buying you drinks, sales. Eventually, those rules changed because some people got a little too drunk at work and like couldn't finish the shift at the end of the night, couldn't clean the bar. I was breaking bottles. I was dropping stuff. I was forgetting stuff. I couldn't count the money at the end of the night. My alcoholism really took off at that point. But again, like, it's hard to get in trouble for your drinking when you work in an environment that's centered around booze. And with people who tend to party, like if you work in the service industry, and I'm not saying this is everybody, but at least at the place I worked, like it was a party spot. Everybody I worked with, you know, we'd get off work at 2 a.m. and then be like, where are we going now? And so everybody liked to go out after work. We'd be out till 4 a.m. And that's when things really started to escalate for me. And during this time, my alcoholic parents who were just, at that point, their drinking was so out of control. And again, that's keeping me separated from recognizing my own issues all this time because I'm not like them. You know, I'm different. I'm having fun. My life isn't suffering. I'm not losing jobs. My relationship with my boyfriend is fine. We have money. We have a house like that. You know, I'm not having any consequences. So, it was really hard to see that it was problematic, especially when I had these examples in front of me of people who were literally, my dad would wake up with tremors and couldn't sign the credit card receipt with a pen when he would go to buy like alcohol in the morning. So I, you know, I'm around these people who are drinking all day from the minute they open their eyes until the minute they close them. And I wasn't that. So it, yeah, it was hard to see how problematic it was, but they ended up getting sober. And my dad went to treatment. I had to help get him in somewhere. He ended up having a health issue that was not alcohol related, but he ended up in the hospital. And when he got there, I told the doctor, like, hey, he's an alcoholic. He's probably going to start going into withdrawal soon. You should give him something. And they kept him in the hospital for a few days and fully detoxed him there. And by the time he was detoxed, I said, hey, this is the longest you've ever gone without a drink. Why don't you go to rehab? And he said, okay. So I caught him in like a vulnerable moment.
Are you sober at this point yourself?
No, wow. I am a disaster. But you know, they were always worse off than me. So I just seem like this normal party girl. And my parents are the ones with like the severe debilitating alcohol problem. So I haven't woken up yet. I'm so focused on them and their issues and how much worse they are than I am.
No, I just thought I just think it's interesting because you know about rehab and you're in your mind, you're like, if I ever get to this point, then I will go to rehab, but I'm not there yet. So, but they need to go to rehab.
Yeah. Yeah. It never crossed my mind that like I would be a candidate for something like that. I should have just checked the whole family at that point. You know, at that point it was just my dad. He was the worst one. So it was like, man, you know, I never thought he would go. He was the kind of guy who he had been admitting for years he was an alcoholic. And he said, you know, but nobody can help me. Like, I'm just going to do this until I die. So I didn't think he would go, but I think he was in such a vulnerable position with his health. And, you know, he had already gone through the uncomfortable part, which was the detox. So at that point, it's like, why the hell not? So he went, and my mom went off the deep end. She had a really hard time with him being in rehab. She's really codependent. And, you know, also like her alcoholism was through the roof at that point. Like she was drinking wine out of a coffee mug in the morning. She was lashing out. We were getting in like physical altercations at the house. So he's in rehab and she's losing her mind. And I have the therapist from his treatment center calling me saying like, you know, do you think it's a good idea for us to let your mom come and visit this weekend? And I was like, no, she was telling them that she was going to not drink anymore in support of his sobriety, but she was drinking worse than before. Like she went on a bender when he went to treatment. She ended up, I don't know, we had a few big blowouts and I think with the advice of his therapist there, he distanced himself from her. And when it came time for him to go home, he got his own apartment instead of coming back to the house. Mm-hmm. And she lost her mind. So she decided one day that she was done with everybody and everything. And she took an entire bottle of pills and tried to end her life. I had been getting some really weird text messages from her that day. So I went over there to check on her because I just had a bad feeling. And I found her pretty much unconscious and had to call 911, and she had to go to the hospital and get her stomach pumped. And then she ended up in a psych unit for a suicide attempt. They hold you for 3 days after that, but they kept her for 6 because she kept insisting that she wanted to get out so she could finish what she started. Mm-hmm. So she was really in like a psychosis at that point. So we had to find her a treatment center. We sent her somewhere in Kentucky and she went away for 2 months. And it's funny, she got there, she was thinking that she was there for, you know, emotional issues and codependency and trauma. And she left there realizing that she also was an alcoholic. And she said, like, I couldn't realize my own issues because your dad's were so bad, and comparing myself against him, I just didn't see that that was my problem too. It just looked different. So now okay, I have two parents.
I feel like I have to interject because this is very, very important. And it's something that we've seen 2 cases of it now where people are bad or in a situation where they feel like, and now looking back in a situation where you feel like you needed help, but you kept looking at the other person who was worse off and saying, right. Oh, but that person's worse. Oh, I'm fine. I'm not as bad as them.
You know? Right. So and I'm okay. Like,
there's a lesson in here because the whole point of this podcast too is to teach people lessons with our stories. If there's somebody else who is younger, who's going through these same issues or somebody who is struggling with it, I want them to understand and learn from you too. So don't wait till you're that worst person. Or you're the worst person in the group. Understand that you have your issues and start working on them proactively.
The best thing I can say about, at least in terms of like alcoholism and drug addiction, is we are all unique, right? If anything, your podcast highlights that, like, you know, how unique we all are, how different our journeys are, our backgrounds are. Look at like our physical makeups. Like, I'm a tiny person. I'm not going to be able to drink and tolerate alcohol the same way as somebody who's 6'5", you know? So, I mean, we're all different.
6'11".
I wasn't referring to you specifically, but okay. Yeah, so you could probably drink me under the table. You know what I mean?
You would think. It sounds good in theory, but no. I think like two glasses of anything, wine or anything, I'm done. That's it.
Lucky you. Honestly, what a blessing.
Cheap date.
That's what I say now. I'm a cheap date. It's great. But yeah, I mean, with how unique we all are, I don't think that the, you know, coming to an answer about whether or not you have a problem is going to look the same for everybody. So I'm a therapist, right? We have a like a diagnostic manual that we use to diagnose different disorders. It's called the DSM, and it is used universally around the world as a standard diagnostic measure. At this point in my life, when I'm, how old am I here when I leave off at that part of the story? You know, both my parents get sober, I'm like 23. And at that stage in my life, if I had opened the diagnostic manual and looked up all these different substance use disorders, I would not have met the criteria. I would not have checked enough boxes to be diagnosed as somebody with a substance use disorder. And that was just because, you know, I didn't drink all the time. I didn't really have tolerance issues. I didn't have DUIs. I wasn't having legal trouble. There's all these different check boxes that you go down. And if I had looked at something like that back in the day, I would not have put myself into that category. I still thought that I was just having fun. Eventually I got to the point where I could have checked all those boxes. But if you're out there and you're questioning your relationship with alcohol, my first question to you would be like, you know, just that, do you feel like you have a relationship with alcohol? I think those of us who identify ourselves that way have something to take a look at. You know, you talk about barely being able to tolerate two drinks. You don't have a relationship with alcohol. You're an occasional drinker, you know, and you're someone who doesn't even really enjoy it. There's some of us who binge and maybe we go a couple days or weeks or even months between binges. But when you go on one, you know, you can't stop. There's this feeling of being out of control, right? Some of us open our eyes in the morning and have vodka on the nightstand and have to drink some just to get out of bed. Some of us go through full-blown withdrawal symptoms, seizures, shakes, sweats. If in the absence of our substance. So it shows up in all these different ways, but I think the question to ask yourself is, you know, are drugs or alcohol taking away anything from my life? So I think for normal people who can go out and have a glass of wine with dinner, alcohol adds maybe to your experience, right? I had a nice time. I ate a steak. I had a glass of wine. You know, it's not doing any harm. You could take it or leave it. It doesn't put your relationships or your safety or anything else in your life in jeopardy. But for those of us who drink problematically, alcohol is a thief of pretty much anything in our lives. And if you're someone who's high functioning like I was, right? If you're pulling off school and doing well, or you're, you know, you still have your job and you're good at your job and you haven't blown all your money and your wife hasn't left you and, you know, you still have what seems to be a pretty intact life, then you look internally like, well, what is it taking away from me personally? Do I feel like I'm my best self? Do I feel like I'm my highest self? Do I feel like I'm living my best life when I'm drinking? And I think that's a question that a lot of us don't look enough at when we're exploring whether or not maybe we need to take a look at our drinking. Is what is it doing to me internally? I think a lot of times we look at the external consequences, like I never had a DUI, you know, I never lost a job. And that was me when I first got sober. I didn't identify with any of the stereotypical consequences that other people had. At first, I was okay with that. I was just, you know, I got sober on an ultimatum the first time. So I was 20, 23, maybe 24. And I went to my first AA meeting. My boyfriend gave me an ultimatum that he was going to break up with me if I didn't get sober. And he had actually gotten sober. He was an alcoholic and a drug addict too. And actually, he's still drinking to this day. So, you know, he went and he told me, you know, I went to my first AA meeting. I picked up a white chip. I'm ready to be sober. And I hope that you can get on board and do this with me. And I was like, yeah, you know, I'll stop drinking out of support for you and your decision. Like, I'm still not ready to look at me. Okay. It's all about like supporting him. I didn't slow down. I didn't stop. I revved up. It was like I had this subconscious rebellion of like anybody coming close to like putting out this fire, I threw gasoline on it and I was going out. I went on a 10-day bender. A lot of nights I didn't come home. I was drinking more than ever. There's a 10-day span of my life that I just don't remember anything. I finally came to my senses and I said, I think I probably have an issue too. And I drove myself to an AA meeting. I didn't tell anybody. I just went. And at this point, both my parents are sober. Now my boyfriend's sober. Like the walls were like closing in on me. It was only a matter of time. And I think like in the back of my mind somewhere, I knew that. So that day was the day. It was March 28th. And I drove to an AA meeting and I sat there in the back row and cried the entire time. I picked up a white chip at the end of the meeting and some lady I didn't know hugged me and just told me she was glad I was there. And I felt like a sense of relief. I felt really safe and I stuck with it for a year and a half. I actually was like excited to be sober, but I found a lot of discrepancy between my experience with alcohol and other people's. I had been going to AA meetings every day. That's like what's suggested of you when you're new. And that's just where I got sober. I know there's a lot of people who do it without AA or any kind of 12-step program. But for me, that was what worked. AA saved my life. Highly recommend, you know, following what's outlined in the program, getting a sponsor, working the steps. I just think that there's a lot of magic in that fellowship. So that's like where I found my home was there. And I felt like I belonged. I felt like people understood me. I found hope in the fact that people had been sober longer than I had been alive. Wow. And like they were successfully living a life without alcohol. But the longer I stuck around, and I think like some doubt started to creep in about my age. I was young. I was in my early 20s. And, you know, these women were like my mother's age. They had amazing lives. They really made sobriety look attractive. And I needed that at the time. Not that that's the most important thing. It sounds very superficial. But I'm the type of person, like, I'm not going to buy into something unless it looks good to me, you know? And these people had, you know, husbands, families, careers they liked. They were as beautiful, like, on the inside as they were on the outside. They had confidence. They were just like a bunch of badasses. Like, they had something I wanted. And, you know, it was easy.
We all chase success though. Like nothing wrong with that. I don't necessarily think that's superficial. I think that we all want to be successful. So we model ourselves after people who are successful.
Absolutely. I mean, if I walked in the room and saw a bunch of people who looked depressed and miserable, like why do I want to do that?
Why would I want to be like, you know? Yeah.
I'm in my early 20s. I thought I was having fun drinking until everyone else pointed out that I wasn't. So you know what I mean? Like I would have had a hard time buying into that. So I found this group of like amazing women and they took me under their wing. But the longer I stuck around, I was like, I don't have that much in common with these people. You know, they're a lot older than me. Like they got sober a lot later than me and they had DUIs and they had been arrested and they had been institutionalized and they had to go to detox and I didn't have to go to detox and maybe I wasn't that bad. And, you know, they had custody battles with, you know, they ended up getting divorced and they almost lost their kids and, you know, they were having shakes and throwing up blood and, you know, all these things. And I, you know, I didn't have any of those things. My job is still here. My boyfriend's still here. I still have a roof over my head. I got money in the bank. I'm doing good. I own my own business. Like, I found all these ways to separate myself from what I was hearing in these AA meetings. And instead of looking for ways to be similar and identify with these people, like on the emotional level, right? The pain that I felt, the lack of confidence I had in myself, the empty hole that alcohol left in my heart. Like I hated myself, you know, I didn't like my life. I didn't like what I was doing. I woke up feeling like shit every day. I wasn't satisfied in any area of my life. I continued to bartend because it was comfortable and I was too scared to go after what I really wanted to do.
You're bartending while you're in AA meetings.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. I was a sober bartender for like years. I did that for a long time. I ended up leaving eventually once I decided to go to grad school, but it was just something that I stuck with until I figured out what I wanted to do. But it was like I was afraid to step out and do anything. I was just afraid to be a failure. I liked not caring about anything. And you know, those were all things that I could hear in AA meetings too, but instead I was hearing about stuff that made me so unique and different from everyone who was an alcoholic in there. And so eventually, after a year and a half sober, you know, my life is good and things are getting better for me and I feel good about myself and my relationships are stable. Like everything's good. I decide to drink again.
So I would love to hear about this part because nobody's ever a finished product and you always go through doubts, no matter what mm-hmm. phase of life you're in. And there's also this thing about a pull that pulls you back to what's normal. I won't say, right. I want to say what's comfortable, but it's not necessarily comfortable. It's just what you know. And what you know could usually, sometimes it's what's bad for you, but it's so normal for you. That's like, I don't want to go to the unknown. So tell right. me about the first time you broke your sobriety.
So at that point, I already have like the seed of doubt is planted in my mind. And I, along wow. the way of getting sober that first time, my long-term boyfriend and I had broken up. We just got sober and like grew apart. Cause I was really, I mean, I was working hard, in AA and like really committed to my sobriety for a while before I started to have these second thoughts. So, I was like really growing and changing and like, you know, building up my life again and starting to get some self-esteem back. And the longer we stayed sober, I was like, I don't have anything in common with him. You know, this isn't working. So we broke up. And of course, like any young girl looking to fill a void in the absence of alcohol, I latched on to another guy instead and like immediately jumped into another relationship. And this guy was much older than me, but he was really successful and he had his shit together. And he didn't know anything about my past and my history and how bad things used to be and how out of control I was. So I thought like, great, fresh start. Like he doesn't know the old me. He's only going to get to know the new me. And I really like that. You know, I have a clean slate here. He asked a lot of questions just, you know, out of curiosity because he didn't really understand alcoholism. He was like, so you can't just have one, you know, you think you're going to do this forever. Like, you don't think that someday you're going to like outgrow this phase of your life and be able to handle just one. And I was like, no, you know, this is like a lifelong decision for me. And at that point, you know, I was really committed to that. I meant that, but he drank, he was like a normal, you know, he didn't drink a lot. He just drank every once in a while. But he said, you know, if you ever change your mind, it's okay. I'm going to support you no matter what you do. Just talk to me about it. So we went out to dinner one night and it was the grand opening of this restaurant and we have dinner. And at the end of the night, the owner of the restaurant walks over and says like, thanks for being, you know, some of our first customers on our first night open. Here's a glass of champagne for you guys on the house. And he puts two glasses of champagne on a table. And I mean, with it like a reflex with no defense, no second thought, no hesitation, I picked up the glass and I drank it. I stunned both my boyfriend and myself. I don't think either one of us were like expected. He just looked at me like, what did you just do? And I was like, I have no idea. And he said, well, does that count? I said, Yeah, that counts. And we just didn't talk anymore about it. We walked home, and that I was feeling really proud of myself secretly, because that's like the first time in my life I ever just had one drink. So I was like, AA worked. I'm cured. I'm not like asking where we're going to go next. I'm not going to like crack open a bottle of wine when we get back to the house and keep going. Like, I just had one drink and I'm good with that. AA cured me. Like, I just needed a little break. I'm good. I was drunk at 10 o'clock the next morning. Overnight. Okay. And after a year and a half sober, I became the alcoholic that I never thought I would be. So all the things before that I was like, that hasn't happened to me. I don't do that. I'm not like that. You know, those women that, of course, they were about to lose a job, lose kids, lose husbands, but I wasn't that bad. Like, all those things that hadn't happened to me just hadn't happened to me yet. Oh. And I went off the deep end. I ran out that day to go grab something or run errands. And I ended up finding a bar. I went to the mall, and you know how the mall's got like restaurants and bars sprinkled all throughout it. Like, I was shopping around the mall and intermittently running into bars and drinking. And it's 10 o'clock in the morning. The mall just opened. I drive home drunk at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon with all these shopping bags. I have no idea, you know, what I've been doing all day, what time it is. And I walk in the door. My boyfriend's like, oh my God, what have you been doing? And I was like, we got to get to happy hour. It's almost 4 o'clock, like wrap up work, close the laptop, get off the phone. We're going to happy hour. And he was just like, oh my God. He had no idea what he was in for. This poor guy. Poor guy. And that continued on pretty much for 4 months. I was out of control. I was drinking pretty much all day, any chance I could get. I was masking it with social activities and outings and getting together with friends, but I was drinking at home by myself too.
But tell me what changed though. What happened from the one night where you have a sip of alcohol or a glass of champagne and you say, oh, I'm cured, to the next time drinking at the mall the next morning and the next time and the next time? What happens in your mind now? Because
I don't know. Cured. It was like reawakening this beast. Like, I don't know what came over me. I think that something in my head, was maybe rebelling against like all that time that I had been sober and locked it up, you know, that it was like, I deserve this. And like maybe subconsciously too, I was like testing myself a little bit, like how out of control can I get before I can like hit the brakes and reel it back in a little bit. And I verbally, like when I was talking to my friends and stuff and, you know, they were watching me go downhill really fast, I was like, I'm making up for lost time. You know, I have a year and a half sober that I have to make up for. I spent a lot of time not having any fun. Like, I'm going to go have some fun. So I was still doing the same song and dance before that. I was like this great time, and, you know, I had it all together and I was just here to have a good time. But I mean, there's nothing social and fun about like hiding vodka in your closet. And lying about how much you've had to drink and pouring it in water bottles and putting it in the trunk of your car. It took on a completely different mask this time. Like I was doing a lot more sneaking around before. I feel like I was like an alcoholic in plain sight, you know, everyone could see my behavior, and just like, I surrounded myself with people who were like me. So nobody questioned it. This time it was like, even those friends were like, you know, something really dark is going on with you here.
Tell me about rock bottom. Tell me about the point where you get to where you're like, okay, this is horrible.
So I, you know, was drinking a lot, and it was like a pretty quick downward spiral. I mean, it was only 4 months that I had relapsed, and I pretty much ran my life into the ground. So I had moved away, not far, just like an hour away from where I lived. So I was away from my friends and family. My boyfriend and I moved. And I love the rock bottom thing, because I think people picture rock bottom as like, you've lost everything, right? You have nothing left. Everything bad is piled up now and you have to hit your lowest low to start coming back up. And it certainly felt that way for me at the time, but I had like a very high class rock bottom. I was living in a $1 million house in Fort Lauderdale with a like spine surgeon boyfriend. I wasn't working anymore. I sat at home and laid by the pool and drank all day. You know, I owned this business that I wasn't doing much with, but like I had it pretty good. I had a brand new BMW in the driveway and I ended up totaling it, getting into two accidents in the same night. So here's something that had never happened to me before. You know, people would talk about DUIs all the time in AA meetings. And I was like, I never had one of those. But the reality was I was driving drunk like every day and I just never got caught. I was lucky that I never got caught. But this particular night, I had lost my mind. My boyfriend was just about done with me. He had gone on a 2-week trip out of the country and went somewhere really remote that he didn't have any cell phone service. And so he needed to get away from me that bad that he went on like a hunting trip in the middle of nowhere and couldn't talk to me for 2 weeks. And so I sat at home pretty much drinking myself to death. He came home and I was intoxicated when I picked him up from the airport. And the minute he saw me, he was like, enough is enough. Like, you got to move out. You got to go. He was like, you know, maybe we'll work things out and try to see what happens if you decide to get your shit together, but you got to get out of my house. This is too stressful for me. So I had a friend who lived down the street and he let me like crash on his couch because I was convinced that this guy was going to take me back, right? Like, of course he's going to change his mind. Mm-hmm. I'm so delusional at this point that I don't realize, you know, how irrational that was. But yeah, I like couch surfed on my friend's couch down the street, waiting for the phone to ring from my boyfriend that he wanted to take me back. So we decide to go one night out to, just like out with friends. And I'm like, yes, thank God. Like, he wants to be around me. This is a good sign. He definitely wants me back. I'm going to, you know, weasel my way back in. So we go out. And of course, when I'm trying to be on my best behavior and not screw things up, I get obliterated, like can barely speak, intoxicated. And I don't know what happened. I blacked out. And the next thing you know, I am alone. Hours later, my phone is off. No one's around. I'm in a bar by myself and I call him and I'm like, you know, where are you? I thought we were together. Like, what, how did I get separated from the group? And he said, well, you freaked out. You threw a drink in my face and stormed off. And I've spent the last 3 hours looking for you downtown and I couldn't find you anywhere. So I finally took a cab home. And, I said, oh man, I'm so sorry. I don't know what happened. And he was like, yeah, me either. Can you just come home? Like, just get in a cab and come to my house. I'm worried about you. I don't know why you're running around downtown by yourself. I don't know where you are, but just get in a cab and come home. And I said, no problem. I'll be right there. We lived like less than a mile from downtown. So I told him I was going to get in a cab and come to the house. And I got in my car instead. And I don't remember any of this, but I hit another car pulling out of downtown. I rear-ended somebody at a red light and I threw the car in reverse and sped off. And then pulling onto my street, I think speeding to get away from the scene of the accident, I hit a tree in somebody's front yard and they were like standing outside watching the whole thing. And my car was totaled and I jumped out of the car and I realized somebody was standing right there and they said, you know, we're going to call the police that you look drunk and, you know, you're pretty banged up and the car is in bad shape. And I was like, please don't call the cops. Please don't call it, you know, and they were like, no, we're calling them. And I took off running on foot and I left my car there. And as I'm running home, I'm 2 blocks from my house. Okay. I'm that close. I'm 2 blocks from my house. I'm running. And I see the cops coming this way towards me, like coming down the street. And I dove in a bush, I hid, they get to the scene of the accident. I take off in the dark to my house. I get home. My boyfriend doesn't realize what just happened. I don't realize what just happened because I woke up the next morning and I looked outside and I could not for the life of me figure out why my car wasn't in the driveway. I had no idea. I was like, man, I must have taken a cab last night. My car's not here. And he's like, yeah, you told me on the phone you were taking a cab. So I'm looking for my stuff and I can't find my stuff, like my purse, not my keys. I can't find anything. And I'm like, oh shit, like, you know, maybe I left everything in the car. So we we go downtown to pick my car up, and I knew exactly where I parked it because I parked it at my friend's house, and it wasn't there. And we drove around for about an hour, and finally he was like, maybe it got towed. Let's go home and we'll call the tow truck company. And as we're pulling into the neighborhood, I see this busted up tree and I see tire tracks in somebody's front yard. I just had this bad feeling in the pit of my stomach. And I was like, I think I did that. So what are you talking about? I just have a bad feeling. I think I did that. And he was like, okay, well, you need to call a lawyer when we get home instead. And sure enough, the police had my car and they wanted somebody to like answer for what happened. And I'm still probably drunk at this point, so I'm definitely not going to go down there and talk to them. But they were keeping my car for an investigation, and I couldn't figure out why, because at this point I only saw that I had hit the tree, right? And mind you, it's crazy that it takes this long for me to figure out that my car was involved in an accident, because I have an egg coming out of my forehead. I have burns all over my chest from the airbag. I have a bruise that's the same size, shape, and position as the seatbelt. I have scrapes all over my arms because I think I fell when I was running from the cops. So, I mean, I'm banged up and I don't feel good. And, you know, without even paying any attention to like these physical injuries, it never crossed my mind that I got into a wreck. So I saw, it took for me seeing the tree and then putting all the pieces together to be like, ooh, I think I did that. So in any case, the police held onto my car for a couple weeks and I couldn't figure out why it was taking so long. Like I hit a tree, you know, and I hit an oak tree and they're protected in Fort Lauderdale. So of course, like they're telling me I have to replace the tree and I'm like, I'll do it all. You know, I don't care. I'll do it. And they call me in 2 weeks later to go have like sit down and have a meeting with them. And so I show up with my lawyer. And I should mention too, that the night before that was my best friend's birthday, like my best friend in the whole world. It's her birthday. She's a couple years younger than me and she was turning 21. And
all this is happening. You're 23 years old. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
When I read your story and you said I was 24. I was like, wow, that's really young. And now I'm hearing your story. Like all this happened before you were 24 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah. I mean, I lived a lot in a very, very short amount of time.
Wow.
And life fell apart like very quickly for me, you know, like within a matter of 4 months, I just came unraveled and I was drinking in a way that I heard other people describe and couldn't understand, even being like an alcoholic in AA, you know, the first time. Like I couldn't wrap my head around the stories I was hearing from other people about how they hid their drinking and, you know, they were putting vodka in water bottles. Like I never did that unless I was trying to sneak it into like a football game in college. You know what I mean? Like I just never, there was never any reason to hide anything. And like very quickly, I became that person. I can remember going to Publix multiple times a day, the grocery store, multiple times a day. And I would keep telling my boyfriend I forgot something and I had to go back. But it's because the bar in the grocery store shopping center offered 2-for-1 drinks all day. And I kept going in there and they would slide 2 drinks over the bar. I'd suck them down really fast. I'd walk into the grocery store and buy one thing. So I would come in with a bag and look like I had a reason to be out again. And I would do that multiple times a day. And those are like the kinds of stories that I would hear that I never related to. And now all of a sudden I was living that. So, you know, it happened so fast. But yeah, it was my best friend's birthday, October 22nd. And she was turning 21 and I went out for her birthday. And the lawyer who was representing me for all the car accident stuff was actually a mutual friend of both of ours. So she was out for my friend's birthday too. It was low key. We had like a nice little dinner and, you know, it was fun and we were all drinking wine. And then everyone was going to go out and like kind of bar hop around downtown after. And my lawyer, it was like 9:30 at night. My lawyer was leaving and she looked at me and said, we have an appointment with the Fort Lauderdale Police Department at 9:00 tomorrow morning. I need you on your A game. I need you presentable. I need you in long sleeves to cover up all these scabs and scars and burns all over your body. I need you to just be quiet and let me do the talking. And I need you to not be drunk. So can you please, like, I'm leaving to go home right now and get a good night's sleep so we can do a good job with the cops tomorrow. Can you please do the same? And I said, you know what? Great idea. I'm right behind you. And I grabbed my stuff. She walked to her car and I was walking to my car. And as soon as I saw her take off, I went back inside and I was like, where are we going next? And I stayed out all night celebrating my friend's birthday, drove home drunk, an hour long drive home drunk, fell asleep at the wheel, veered off the road, woke up just in time, thank God, and somehow made it home. A guy actually saw me cut across all the lanes of the interstate asleep at the wheel, and he pulled off to make sure I was okay. And when he realized how drunk I was, he said, I'm going to follow you home and make sure you get home okay. And this guy followed me all the way home. I was so drunk, I forgot to set an alarm, and somehow the sound of the phone ringing woke me up at 9 o'clock in the morning. And it was my lawyer asking me where I was. So I had to throw clothes on really quick and roll out the door. And I was still drunk from the night before. And I go to meet with the cops. And, you know, I'm 30 minutes late and I'm a mess. I did the opposite of what she suggested that I do. And I looked like an absolute disaster. And I walked in, and that's when they told me that I had been involved in two accidents and that I had hit another car. And thank God the people in the car were okay. But it was like an antique car and they were having a hard time finding replacement parts for it because it was so old, and that I was probably going to get sued for a lot of money. And I was facing four criminal charges for both, between both accidents, for leaving the scene, and property damage. And they couldn't give me a DUI because they didn't like catch me that night drunk. But they said, it's pretty apparent that you're intoxicated right now. You know, if we can suggest, like, we saw that you had a bunch of Alcoholics Anonymous books in the back seat of your car, and you should probably start going back to those meetings again. And I was like, yeah, noted, I will. And so they drive me to this police impound lot. And this is the first time I'm seeing my car since the accident. I didn't know how bad it was. And when I walked in, the guy who was like retrieving my vehicle said, I can't believe you were the person driving that car. Are you okay? I was like, yeah, I'm fine. They bring my car out and it's unrecognizable. Like, it's a miracle that I walked away from that accident alive. And here I am alone at the police impound lot, crying on the shoulder of a big, huge tow truck driver who doesn't know me, looking at my vehicle, wondering, you know, how I'm alive. And there's the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, this blue book, sitting on the back seat of my car. And I knew exactly then what I needed to do. And I went straight to an AA meeting. I called my mom and I was like, I got to go to a meeting. And she said, I've been waiting for you to call me. You know, at that point, my family didn't, I never came out and said like, hey, I'm drinking again. But I had moved like 45 minutes away from home and hadn't really seen them, and was, you know, isolating away from everybody who knew that I was supposed to be sober. And was so ashamed that I was drinking again. I just have distanced myself from my family, and my mom knew.
Isn't that funny how we do that when we are doing something wrong, something mm-hmm. we know we shouldn't be doing? We start moving away. I have this conversation with one of my best friends. He's like, I know there's something you're not supposed to be doing, or you're not being the person you mm-hmm. say, because I can feel you slipping away and moving
pulling away.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, shame will keep us so isolated, and that's what it was. And I think also this, like, not feeling ready to get better. I knew at that point, like, my parents are both sober, and if they had taken one look at me at that point, they would have known that I needed help, and I wasn't ready for somebody to do that yet, if that makes sense. Like, I wasn't ready for anyone to step in and intervene. So I just kept hiding. But yeah, I went to an AA meeting, and I've been sober ever since. That was October 23rd. Yeah.
October 23rd, what year? This is
2013.
October 23rd. Oops. That's 2 days after my birthday.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, you've been sober for 7 years, and now you're a therapist.
I am.
Tell me about your job now.
It's amazing. I love it. I love what I do. It took me a few years to figure out what I wanted to do. So I stayed a sober bartender for a while after I got sober, and I was working with a sponsor in AA, and she helped me go through the 12 steps. And once we finished that, she said that, you know, I think there's a couple other things we need to take a look at. And one of them is what's next. Like, what's next for you? You're not going to work in a bar forever. It's just not who you are. You have so much to offer. And
I can't believe nobody told you to get out of the environment.
There were definitely people who had an issue with me working in a bar, but I used to tell them it was like an insurance policy on my sobriety every time I worked, because I would see a lot of the behavior that I didn't want to engage in anymore. I think that was an excuse at the time to just like make the environment that I was in okay. Like I didn't really have, I wasn't in the headspace to like go out and look for another job. You know what I mean? I was so focused on like repairing all the damage I had just done during that relapse and like just trying to get my head on straight that I was in no position to be like out looking for a job. And I didn't know what I wanted to do anyway. I just lacked a lot of direction. And at that point it was keeping it simple for me. Like, you just need to go to a meeting and not drink, and like the rest is going to work itself out. So, yeah, like today I could never work in a bar, not because I would be afraid to drink, but because I would be afraid that I'd be like too mouthing off to drunk people, because I can't stand to be around that kind of atmosphere anymore. But yeah, my sponsor sat me down and she gave me a homework assignment. She was like, you know, I want you to figure out what you want to do. And I said, I don't know. I don't know what I want to do. And she said, okay, well, I want you to go talk to people. I want you to start taking women out for lunch and coffee and asking them about their jobs and asking them how they got their jobs. Did they have to get a special certification or go to school? What did they study? What did they plan for? How did they get into their job? What do they like about it? What do they not like about it? What would they do instead if they weren't doing that thing? So I did. I started like interviewing women who had jobs and were successful. And I learned in that process that I really wanted to be a therapist. And so I started looking into what I would need to do, and I needed to go back to grad school. And this is like maybe March at this point. And I pull up the local school because I wasn't trying to go away. I wanted to stay put for a little while. And there's a school down the street that had the program that I wanted, and the application deadline was a week from the day that I looked into it. So I applied real quick and I got all my, you know, my essays written, my letters of recommendation, all that stuff. And I sent it in the day before the deadline. And I heard back 3 weeks later that I had gotten in. So it all happened like really fast. But I feel like when you're doing the right thing and you're doing stuff that's meant for you, it comes together much easier.
I guess what I want to know also is how your story also helps you now as you're a therapist, and you're helping people through their own sobrieties and those journeys.
So it's interesting from a therapy standpoint, ethically, you know, like their session, like what's going on with the client really isn't about me. As much as you'd think there would be like a lot of personal advice to offer people who are going through something similar to what I've been through, you know, it's not about me. It's about helping them find their own answers and their own way. So, and that's something I think people kind of, there's like a misconception about therapy anyways, you know, like therapists don't give advice. We might provide suggestion or give people tools and techniques that they can use, or arm them with some skills to, you know, to work through the different circumstances in their lives. But it's really about empowering you to come up with your own conclusions, to develop your own insight, to identify, you know, it's not for me to tell you that something in your life is a problem. That's for you to uncover. So I might ask the right questions that gets you to draw that conclusion on your own. But you know, like the answer is always within you. It's within all of us. That's kind of what our job is.
I think that therapy has a bad negative stigma. You know, people think that therapy is for people who have these huge problems and are diagnosed with mental issues. And those are the people that need to go to therapy. I think that everybody has something to work on. I think that
always.
It's important to have a neutral person with expertise to sit there and listen to you and give you advice on your some of your issues, because a lot of times you have your emotions attached to different things. What's your take on that?
I completely agree with you. I think that anybody could benefit from having this neutral, non-judgmental third party to talk to maybe help you gain some perspective on your life. Like sometimes when we're living things, right? When we're so close to something it's hard to see the big picture. It's like hard to see our way out. So for a lot of us, like sometimes we can't unlock these solutions to problems in our lives because we're too enmeshed in them. And so when you sit down with somebody who doesn't, you know, doesn't have any stake in the game, right? Like their only job is to support you and to help you. And they don't have any judgment of you. They're not there to tell you what to do. They're not there to make decisions for you. They just want to hear you and help you draw your own conclusions and come up with a solution that feels good for you. Like, who wouldn't benefit from that? You know, I still see a therapist. I saw her right before I saw you this morning. I had her from 9:30 to 10:30 this morning. Great time. She's amazing. So even as a therapist and with 7 years sober and a great life, like, people might be like, you know, why are you in therapy? Because we all need to talk to somebody.
You've already shown though, and you've already kind of shown an example of when everything is going good, that little devil comes and kind of creeps on your shoulder. So it's a journey. It's something that you have to keep staying on top of. And that's what anything is. It's for anybody who wants to stay in shape, right? Because that one day you're tired, you're like, oh, I don't really feel like doing it today. And then it turns into 2 days and 3 days, and all of a sudden your discipline goes out the window. So it's a little step-by-step progress to get to where you're trying to go. But it's also really quick how you can lose that step-by-step progress. You can see from the story you've told. I also want to talk about, so you have a little boy, he's 15 months old, and you called him, you know, your biggest sober gift.
Yes.
How does your mindset also change after having a baby when you have someone depending on you in this journey of yours?
Oh my, I mean, how does it not change? I feel like everything changed the minute he entered the world, and like in all the best ways possible, but then also in like the scariest ways possible. And I don't mean that negatively. He's the best thing that ever happened to me. But anybody who's a parent will understand that like your anxiety and your worry and your fear, like everything seems so much scarier when you have this other little life to be responsible for. You know, it feels like a lot of pressure. They don't come with instruction manuals. You know, you just figure it out as you go. And that can be really overwhelming. I feel like a lot of things have changed within like my own personal mindset. I feel like I'm more committed to like really being the person I want to be and like really being the best version of myself and obviously staying the course with my sobriety. Like I don't struggle with my sobriety anymore. I'm so grateful to be sober. I don't have any desire to drink. I'm really grateful for that. And I know that's not everybody's experience, but I don't ever think about it anymore. Like it's not an option for me. It feels like life or death. And today I choose to live. But I have a son now. So like, it's really not an option for me. And I also know how I grew up and my parents were alcoholics and I don't ever want my kid to see me drunk. And that's up to me. You know what I mean? Like that's on me. So, you know, I need to stay like up on myself, working my program, doing the things that help me to be better every day. I'm not just cured because I have 7 years and I don't think about alcohol anymore. I might think about it tomorrow. You know, I might think about it later today. Like, I don't know if and when that's ever going to pop back up for me. So I just have to stay on top of what I do. And like, obviously it's hard when you have a baby, it's a huge adjustment and you have your hands full. So definitely like in the self-care department, I was like totally slacking for a little while because I had to take care of this baby and learn how to do that. Man, like that kid, every day I have a reason not to drink. And like, it's for, if not for me, then for him, you know?
That's so beautiful. And I'm glad that you're using your son as motivation as well.
Absolutely.
I know we're running out of time. I have two more questions. Maybe you can answer them from really quick.
Okay.
Your husband himself is pretty interesting. And, you know, he could easily feature on this podcast as well. You know, 6 years sober.
You would love him.
Yeah, 6 years sober from heroin addiction, and he runs a treatment center. So you both are using your stories to help other people. You know, is there a part of his journey or your journey or your journeys together that you would like to share?
Nothing specifically that I can think of other than the fact that we're both sober today. I think that's the best part of the journey because there's hope in that. So like if you're struggling and with anything, not just with drugs or alcohol, but we both had problems that we thought were going to kill us before we could beat them, you know? And like his path, his journey, his story is like completely different than mine. Like his experience is not my experience. And that's why I think it's so important. Like I was talking to you about earlier, you know, to really try to like take an honest look at ourselves and the problems that we're having and the things that we know in the back of our mind are holding us back. And for us, it was drugs and alcohol, but to be like, you know, is this behavior, whatever it is that I'm doing, whether it's drinking, drugs, you know, like an eating disorder, a shitty toxic relationship, something like something that's holding you back. You know, what is this doing for my life right now? Does it make me feel good? Is it adding or taking away? And so for us, like the best part of our story is that, you know, we're still here. Like we got to wake up this morning, and that's something that a few years ago for both of us might not have been a reality.
That's the one thing I think everybody also needs to understand is no matter what your past is, you have a chance today. And, you know, it might seem like it's, you know, a saying that people say all the time. So it might go in one ear and come out the other.
Right.
But I had a coach say to me one time, he said, I never had a problem turning the chapters, turning the pages of my life. And I never understood it at that point as a kid. I didn't understand what he was saying, but he was saying, I've never been in a situation where I felt like I couldn't do it. And that's one of the things we need to understand about ourselves. We are strong enough to take this new chapter, which is today, and make a whole new story for the rest of our, you know, you're writing this book and you're not whatever baggage you're carrying. You're not that baggage. Right, you can start today and write a whole new story and they'll be like, wow, look at this other person. So right. I always think that that's important to hear these parts of stories. But this is my favorite question. All right, this is my last question, but it's my favorite question. Because this podcast is about guiding people, I don't want you to think about guiding other people. I want you to think about guiding your younger self. Let's say you were talking to a young Bridget. This is the 13-year-old, 14-year-old. Drinking for the first time or drinking heavily for the first time. If there's something you could tell that young party girl, what advice would you give her?
Oh my, I just would want to give her a hug and tell her, I love you so much. And you are so deserving of anything you want to have. And you can have it, but it's up to you. I think I waited so long. There was so much external validation in my life and also like a lot of external criticism. My dad was really hard on me and expectations were high and low all at the same time in my family. I don't think they had super high hopes for me, but they wanted me to do what they wanted me to do. And I didn't follow that path. And, you know, I was always looking for something outside of me to make me feel complete, like drugs, alcohol, boys, friends, partying, you know, whatever it was. And like, I was complete the whole time. Good. I never acknowledged that within myself. Like, you don't need anything else. Like, you have everything in you.
Wow. Bridget, I can't thank you enough for sharing your story. I'm sure that so many people out there can relate, can learn from, and can use the lessons that you've taught us to just lead better lives and in their rebuilding journeys to becoming the beast that they can become. You have everything that you want to be, right? You have everything that you need. And yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. This was awesome.
Thank you. Thank you. I really enjoyed talking with you. Yeah. I hope that my story has something to offer anybody listening.
You are definitely going to make a change. And please, I really want to implore, please keep going. I don't think that there can be enough people in this space who are being vulnerable, who are trying to use their stories to help others. So I just want to say, please, thank you for what you're doing and keep going. Keep going. If you guys, and you have to tell us where to find you and your social media links.
Yes. Find me on, I only have an Instagram at this point. So find me on Instagram. It's at That Sober Mom, but there's dots in between. So at that.sober.mom.
At that.
And hit me up. I love talking to you guys.
Yes.
Yes. I love getting messages. I love it. My, you know, I don't, it's not very active. I've only had it for a couple of weeks now, but I'm working on getting some more content out there. And I just love connecting with you guys. So whether you have any interest in sobriety or not, if you just want to talk and make a friend and say, hey, please hit me up.
Thank you. Thank you so much. We'll talk soon.
Sounds good. Thank you so much. Bye, guys.